Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Small business owner, you're special among Americans. You are a latter-day pioneer of our society and truly one of America's heroes. Welcome back, heroes. It's 13 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thank you very much for joining us. Our phone number is 888-822-8255 if you would like to join me or our special guest and our good friend, Knight Kiplinger. Knight is the editor of the Kiplinger Letters. You know that those of you who have been listening to the show for a while know that we have at least 1 hour every week discussing the most recent Kiplinger Letter with Joan Pride, associate editor with the Kiplinger Letter. Well, Knight is her boss, and he is here to talk to us about where Kiplinger thinks the world is today and where we're going. His book is called World Boom Ahead, Why Business and Consumers Will Prosper. Knight, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you, Jim.
It's good to have you back with us. And before I get into any questions, I want to congratulate you on what I believe next week will be your 76th anniversary in business.
That's correct.
Not you personally, obviously.
That's right. As you well know, most closely held businesses, family businesses, do not survive to the second generation, let alone to the third.
Mm-hmm.
There are many forces that conspire against the longevity of closely held businesses, starting with estate taxes. Most businesses are sold because the appraised value of the estate at the death of the founder or the largest shareholder is so great that the business has to be sold to pay those estate taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That's how most family farms are sold, most small town newspapers, a lot of other businesses are sold to pay the estate taxes. So maintaining a family business from one generation to the next requires a lot of very clever estate planning, a lot of life insurance, and gifting of stock sometimes to employees and other family members, and it's hard to arrange, and that's why most don't make it.
And the bigger you become, the more complicated it is.
That is the truth.
Yeah.
It's amazing that there's still a number of multi-billion-dollar family-controlled, closely held businesses. The Mars Candy Corporation,
mm-hmm.
SC Johnson Company out in Racine, Wisconsin, the makers of Johnson Wax and many other household products, that's a family-held business. And it's amazing that businesses of that size have managed to pull it off, but I guess they have a lot of very clever counsel, don't they?
Yes, they do. I'm sure they do. Have you guys ever reported on a list of those kinds of companies?
Not a list per se. It's sort of anecdotal evidence. But there are a lot of very large and very old family businesses that are still going on.
Well, you got to take your hats off to those folks, including Kiplinger, for being able to stay privately held over all those years, especially with all the market forces that are going on these days.
Yeah, and it's not a foregone conclusion that's always the best way to do it. In my book, World Boom Ahead, I mentioned that generally most closely held businesses will not continue to be closely held into the next generation, and there's some good reasons besides the negatives of estate taxes. The small business's access to capital is not as broad
mm-hmm.
as the publicly held business. They cannot use their own stock to motivate employees with stock options.
Mm-hmm.
They can't use their own stock to acquire other businesses. In their credit and capital, they're generally limited to bank credit and factors and occasionally some other funders of small businesses. But the publicly held business does have a lot of advantages in access to capital and access to the job market, the ability to attract talented people that the closely held business doesn't have. And that's a big disadvantage.
Absolutely. And folks, now you know why I like to have Knight on the show, because even though he runs a pretty large organization, he knows from whence you and I come, and he deals with it every day in many ways the way we do. Knight, I wanted to ask you a question. Your book's been out, World Boom Ahead's been out about a year or so. Since you wrote the book, has anything changed in the past year that would cause you to rethink your title?
Well, when I brought my book out about a year and a half ago, I cautioned the reader right up front that this was not a short-term forecast. This was a broad look at the global economy over the next 10 or 15 years. You might recall that a year ago, in the late summer and early fall of 98, our stock market was in a slide.
Yep.
Our stock market was going down. It went down nearly 20%.
In fact, as we speak, a year ago, as you and I visited a year ago, it was below 8,000, as I remember.
That's right, and headed south. You might recall mm-hmm. that the major economies of Asia were all in the tank. There was mm-hmm. a lot of concern that the Asian contagion would spread to the United States and bring our growth to a halt.
NASDAQ was under 1,500.
That's right. Brazil was teetering, it seemed, on the verge of collapse. And we asked our readers to look beyond these short-term conditions at the broader picture. Now, even though it wasn't a short-term forecast, I think that a lot of things that have happened in the world economy since then have given a little more credibility to this forecast. The United States was not dragged down by the crisis in Asia. Today, Japan is beginning to bounce back after a recession that lasted most of this decade.
Right.
Japan is finally growing again, which is actually good news for the United States because Japan has long been a very strong market for American goods, but the mm-hmm. last few years they haven't been able to buy as much from the United States. All those countries that were in recession a year ago were dumping their product on the United States. The United States has been the customer of last resort for the whole world economy. We have been snapping up the bargain-priced imports from all over the world. Last year, for the first time in a decade and a half, American exports fell, and that's not a sign of weakness in the American economy. It was simply a sign of weakness in our trading partners overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the dollar weakens so much. When we are selling our dollars to buy other currencies, to buy the imports of other countries, and when other countries can't afford as much of the fine goods and services that the U.S. produces, the dollar predictably and inevitably will weaken. It is not a sign of U.S. weakness at all. It's a sign of weakness elsewhere.
Yes.
Happily, that situation is beginning to turn around right now. Asia is bouncing back. Mexico is strong. Our biggest trade partner, Canada, is doing better now and buying more product from the United States. So I think the dollar will very gradually strengthen over the next 2 years as the rest of the world buys more U.S. product.
Well, a year ago, when we were talking about the market being where it was, the dollar against the yen was like a 143 or 4 or something like that. And now it's just over a dollar, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Night, stand by. We've got to take a break. Folks, it's 20 after the hour. We're visiting with Knight Kiplinger, editor of the Kiplinger Letters. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Also, Knight is the author of World Boom Ahead. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We are back. It's 24 after. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, the editor of the Kiplinger Letters, Knight Kiplinger, and the editor-in-chief of Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, as well as the author of World Boom Ahead. Knight's our special guest and our good friend. And Knight, we've been talking about your book and some of the things that you have to say in your book. One of the things that I wanted to point out is that to my audience is that I've been following the Kiplinger predictions and prognostications over the last probably 15 or 20 years or so, and have been a subscriber for a long time. And I've noticed that you guys have a pretty impressive record with regard to the things that you forecasted, including in the late 80s, you predicted in one of your books that there would be a budget surplus in this decade. You predicted that we would have increased productivity. You predicted that we would have low-price computers, but you also predicted that the Dow would be at 6,000 by the year 2000. And I think and that's probably when it was around 3,000 or something. And I'm sure you took a lot of flack for that. But my question to you is, what would you have said to me in 1989 if I had said, "No, Knight, but by 1999 the Dow will be over 11,000"? What would you have said?
Well, I would have said that you were overly optimistic, and as a matter of fact, we never found anybody who said by the end of the decade of the 90s the Dow would be that high. When we forecast Dow 6,000 in the year 2000, the year was 1989, and the Dow was in the low 2,000 range.
Yeah.
We were talking about a tripling of the Dow in about 11 years, and people said that we were crazy. You might recall that in the late 1980s, there was sort of an economic hypochondria that had settled over America, an economic inferiority complex. Everybody thought that the decade of the 90s would belong to Japan, that a united Europe would leave us behind, Japan would leave us behind, and we were going to have a dismal decade in the 1990s. Many of the pop forecasters in the late 80s said that we were going to have a long hangover. We were going to have our comeuppance in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So we projected strong economic growth in the 90s, and as an emblem of that strong economic growth, we said the Dow Jones Industrial Average will triple to about 6,000 by the end of the decade. And as I said, people thought we were crazy.
Yeah.
They thought that we were Pollyannas. We said, no, that would be a good, solid performance for the U.S. economy and American stocks. So we're delighted that our forecast turned out to be conservative, turned out to be understated, but at the time people thought it was wild.
Well, you know, I remember more than a year ago reporting on your letter where you predicted that the Dow would be at 10,000. You amended your prediction to 10,000 by the end of the century. And I remember kind of, you know, teasing Gary Matthews, who was with us at the time, covering the Kiplinger letters, and about that, and saying, you know, you guys are crazy. So in a teasing way, as I say. But every one of your folks have been able to come back and tell me that, you know, and sort of turn the tables on me a little bit, because it was hard for me to see that it would go to 10. But as you know, it's gone over 11. How much of an impact has the investor class had? This new group of investors that's now, what is it now, over 40%, approaching 50% of Americans are invested in the stock market, and they're being called the investor class by many. How much of an effect are they having in causing the Dow or the stock markets to rise like they are?
They're having a very large effect. Basically, the shareholding public of America is most of America today, because either through direct ownership or through 401ks at their place of business, the vast majority of Americans today are shareholders. They're beginning to think more like the owners of business instead of just the employees of business.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have an entire population beginning to think like small business owners, good things happen. They communicate to Congress that maintaining a good business environment in America with relatively low taxation and relatively low regulation compared to many other industrial countries is good for the United States and good for all the Americans who own shares directly or indirectly in American business. It also seems that this new investor class has finally absorbed the preachings of personal finance advisors like us at Kiplinger,
mm-hmm.
to ignore the dips and the spikes in stock prices, ignore the peaks and valleys, and maintain their equity positions through soaring markets and falling markets, and continue to invest regularly in a disciplined way using a technique called dollar cost averaging.
Right.
We hate market timing. As a matter of fact, when we talk about where I think the Dow will be a year or so from now, I'm uneasy even with that exercise, because my message is it doesn't much matter where the Dow is going to be 6 months from now or a year from now. The historical experience of owning stocks is that over time, they tend to rise and they outperform all other alternative forms of capital.
Tonight, stand by. We've got to take a quick break. Folks, it's 29 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. We'll be right back. We are back. It's 33 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to remind you that my website, which is smallbusinessadvocate.com, is where you can go to hear the show live over the Internet if you're where you can't hear it on the radio. And also, I'll remind you that you can hear this interview with Knight Kiplinger until it's replaced with tomorrow's show from my website. It's available on demand worldwide, wherever you are. If you can get to my website and you have the ability to listen on your radio, on your computer, then you can hear this show rebroadcast on demand from my website, and take advantage of that. Also, Knight Kiplinger is our special guest. Tonight I want to talk about your website, Kiplinger.com. You've got a feature there that we tell people about every week that I really admire and really enjoy using. It's been a great resource for me, and that's your KSS section, the Kiplinger Special Services.
Yes. Like many publishing organizations, we have both the free website, which is advertiser-supported, and we also have a subscription fee-based side of the web shop. Our Kiplinger letters are in our division we call Kiplinger Business Forecasts, and a lot of our subscribers over the years have said, in addition to the terse, crisply written forecast in the Kiplinger letter, they would occasionally like more information about those items, more of the background,
mm-hmm.
some referrals for more information. And for those people who wanted to know more of the background on our forecast, we created Kiplinger Special Service, And that's a modestly priced fee-based service that enables people to query us, ask us for more information on things, ask us to find out information in Washington or elsewhere that would be useful to their business. So it's just beginning to catch on, just beginning to attract a broader audience beyond the Kiplinger letters.
And folks, the address is kiplinger.com, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R.com. Over on the left in the lines, you'll see special services. Click on that, and if I'm not mistaken, there's a free 30-day free trial option there.
That's correct.
And when you select that free trial, and by the way, you can go ahead and subscribe immediately. You don't have to do the free trial if you don't want to, right, Knight?
That's right.
but you also get the letter while you're there. You get access to the letter, and I have really enjoyed that feature, Knight, and I appreciate you making that available. We were talking about the investor class, and you made a comment that I thought was very interesting a minute ago. You said that the investors, more and more average Americans, are as we know, is approaching 50% of Americans own stock these days. And you said they were thinking more like business owners, and their approaches, their thought process on how tax policy should be has got to be changing too, especially with regard to capital gains and other issues like that. How do you see that affecting the way Congress does business, the way our government manages our tax policy over the next few years?
Well, I think that Congress recognizes the power of capital formation in America. They recognize that anything they can do to increase the savings and investment rate is good for the United States. And I think they're also more sensitive to the needs of small business, recognizing that small business accounts for the lion's share of the new job creation in America.
Mm-hmm.
Small businessmen for some time and self-employed people have wanted 100% deductibility of health insurance premiums, which they don't have now, and I think Congress is showing much more sympathy to that. Small business owners have long complained that the threshold for taxation of American estates at $600,000 is too low. If it had been indexed for inflation over the years, there'd be no federal taxation of estates up to $2 million or so. Now, you know there's a schedule in place to gradually lift that $600,000 to $1 million over the next few years.
Yes.
Some people in Congress think that we ought to accelerate that step up of the taxation threshold for estate taxation, and there's some proposals now in Congress to speed up that raising of the estate tax threshold, and that's getting a nice hearing right now. In the discussion over managed care reform and HMO reform, some small business people and even the owners and managers of larger businesses say that a number of these plans would increase the liability exposure of the employer to employee lawsuits if they're unhappy with the health care coverage they got, if they were angry about being turned down for reimbursement on a certain health care expense. And some of these bills, in addition to allowing them to sue their HMO, would also allow them to sue their employer if they're unhappy about health care
coverage.
Simply
because they were the ones that provided them access to that HMO.
That's right. And a lot of business people are saying, look, if Congress increases the liability exposure of small business to suits like this, you're going to see more companies dropping their health coverage altogether. You know, there's no law that you have to provide health coverage to your employees, and if it is onerous or risky to the business to do so, some businesses won't. And that's the wrong direction to go. I think that every business should find a way to provide health insurance to its employees, even if it means getting together with a consortium of other small business owners to buy it as a group. In around the country, there are a number of chambers of commerce and other business groups in small cities that now help small businesses buy insurance of all sorts jointly through a health insurance buying cooperative, and that gives them the buying clout of a larger employer group.
Absolutely. Knight, stand by. We're going to take a break. Folks, when we come back, we're going to get Knight to tell us what Kiplinger thinks is the outlook, the economic outlook for the U.S. over the next 6 to 12 months and a lot of other important things that we've got on our minds. 888-822-8255 if you'd like to ask a question or if you have a comment. I'm Jim Blassingham, the small business advocate. Knight Kiplinger, the editor of the Kiplinger Letters, is our special guest and our good friend. Stay with us. Back is 44 After. I'm Jim Blassingham, the small business advocate. Thank you very much for joining us. Our special guest. guest is our good friend Knight Kiplinger, editor of the Kiplinger Letters. He's also the author of World We Met. Knight, your book is available in bookstores and online, I'm sure.
Yes, it is. People buy it at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. A year and a half after release, it's not as broadly available in bookstores, but it's still on the online stores.
Right. I'm sure they can order it, though, if they want to. And can they buy the book from your website?
Yes, they can.
Okay.
I think we have excerpts of the book on our website, Kiplinger.com, and ordering information as well.
Right. Check that out, folks. It's an excellent book and one of a series. Your family started writing books about the future back in, what was it, in the 30s?
That's right. Yeah, trying to forecast the future of the economy and legislative outlook is our stock and trade every week, but every now and then we step back and take a longer view in a book format.
Right. And folks, the Kiplinger letters include the weekly Washington letter, which is their flagship. Also, they have three biweekly letters, the agriculture letter, the California letter, and the tax letter. And also, don't forget about the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, which used to be called Current Times. Wasn't that the
original name? Changing Times.
I'm sorry, Changing Times. That's
right.
Changing Times. I remember when it was Changing Times.
Yeah.
Speaking of the economy, before we go any further, I want you to talk to us about where you think the U.S. economy is headed over the next 6 to 12 months.
Well, I think it's going to slow down a bit. I do believe that early in the year 2000, the U.S. economy will set the all-time record for the longest expansion in American history. It'll come in at about 9 years since the end of the last recession back in 1991. But the rate of growth is going to slow. I think that the torrid pace of housing construction and resale home sales, auto sales will cool off a bit from those record levels, but still not bad at all. We're beginning to hear that bank credit is tightening a bit. We're hearing from some of our small and medium-sized business subscribers at the Kiplinger Letter that they're not finding credit as easy to come by. Some banks are looking at a rising percentage of non-performing loans and some late payments, and they're saying maybe it's time to tighten our credit. Some of the bank regulators are looking over the shoulder at banks, suggesting that they tighten their lending standards a bit. The job market, remains very, very tight. I'm sure a lot of your small business listeners have a hard time hiring at the wages they're accustomed to paying. In most parts of the country, the minimum wage is history. It's been a long time since anybody could hire at the minimum wage in a lot of boom cities. And small businesses have to compete against larger businesses on their benefits package.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just generally harder to grow right now, and this is going to bring the U.S. economy into a slower range of growth, 3%, a little under 3% over the next year or so.
But still not too shabby.
Not too shabby at all, and especially for 8 to 9 years into an expansion, to still be growing at all is quite a tribute to this economy.
That's incredible, isn't it? And we've got to, obviously, you very correctly attributed the credit to small business owners, because, as you know, they have been the job generator of this decade. Small business owners have, as opposed to the large businesses. But you've also got to give credit to this thing, the internet, that has really changed our lives, hasn't it?
It has indeed, and the internet is one of those forces of creative destruction that will ruin some businesses and will also be exciting business opportunities for others. I talked to a number of specialty retailers around the country who used to serve just a local market, and the internet has enabled them to put their distinctive products and services out to a wider market all over the world. I talked to specialty retailers of such things as maps of foreign countries and laser pointers and specialty antiques and musical instruments, and they say, I used to be a local dealer. I put out an occasional mail order catalog to known collectors, but now with the internet, I'm finding customers in Japan and Rome and South America and all over the United States because they put in the key word of my product line, and up pops my website and my product line, my inventory, right there for all the world to see and to acquire. So every business has got to look at how e-commerce can help them extend their reach to keep in touch with their customers better, to maintain cordial relations with suppliers and customers, improve billing and shipping and all that kind of thing.
Well, another thing that's happening that's very interesting to me is e-banks, online banking. Now, and not online banking in the old sense, like when you could just plug into your local bank, but literally banks that reside online.
That's true, and this is a good opportunity for turning credit markets into truly national auction places. Today, somebody needing a mortgage, somebody needing a small business loan is not limited entirely to the financial institutions in their local area. Now you can go looking for credit all over the world, and especially for fairly standardized types of loans like mortgages. It's a little harder for the small business lender to size up a borrowing prospect online, but there's a little bit of that beginning to do too. Some sources of venture capital and equity capital now have websites where you can get in touch with them and start talking about your business and exchanging information.
Knight, stand by. We're going to take a break. Folks, it's 50 after the hour. We're going to come back and wrap up the hour with Knight Kiplinger, the editor of the Kiplinger Letters. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Blassie, Small Business Advocate. We are back. It's 50 after the hour. Small Business Advocate, Knight Kiplinger, the author of World Boom Ahead, and also the editor of the Kiplinger Letters and the editor-in-chief of Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine, is our guest and our good friend. And we're talking tonight about where Kiplinger thinks the world is and the marketplace is and where small business is currently and where we're headed in the future. And now I want to wrap up the hour by talking about small business specifically. And what does Kiplinger see are some of the biggest threats to small business in the near and midterm?
Well, the largest threat is that the increasing consolidation of one's competitors will make it very hard for the small business to match the marketing muscle, the buying power, and the price discounting that the large competitor is able to do. We're seeing consolidation in every imaginable field today, and the larger company has buying power and clout with its suppliers, the ability to get the message out through massive advertising, and it's hard for the small business to match that. That's why a lot of small businesses are looking around for somebody else to combine with themselves.
Strategic
alliances form a larger combine themselves. And that's why the small business is more endangered today than ever before. It will have to get bigger faster to survive. It can't maintain the luxury of remaining a small niche player forever. If it's going to survive, it has to match the clout of the big boys somehow.
Don't you see, though, and of course the key is, the challenge is to hang on this long, but don't you see down the road there being sort of a resurgence in service and I mean, I know people want price, and small business owners are not going to be able to not have regard for the price points that they offer, but I talk to small business owners about making sure that they provide the kinds of things that the large companies can't provide, which is the kind of personalized service and the technical knowledge that a lot of these big companies can't offer.
That's really true. We have often told retailers that the only way to compete against the big box retailer in their town is to have a different product line, specialty products, find products of higher quality than the big box is carrying, offer to deliver, offer special advice on how to select the product, how to use the product, become a consultant and advisor as well as simply a seller of the product. And service is the way that small business can maintain its edge over somebody whose primary appeal is price.
And you know, even though we've got all these problems, the statistics show that there are 800,000 new small businesses being formed every year, and some of the statistics that I've seen is that by the year, I think 2010, there'll be a million new small businesses, net new, every year.
That is true. They keep getting founded. Hope springs eternal. Some of those small businesses will not make it, but a lot of them will succeed beyond the founder's wildest dreams.
Yeah. I saw one statistic where 1 in 12 employees, this was a survey that was done, 1 in 12 employees in America who are not currently involved in small business, are actively planning to start a small business.
A lot of home-based businesses, a lot of people trying to turn a passionate hobby into a small business, sometimes with great success.
Absolutely. Another thing that I saw recently was the direct correlation between the entrepreneurialism environment of a country and their growth. For example, entrepreneurialism is strong in America, our growth is strong, entrepreneurialism is not strong in Japan, and their growth is not strong. So there's a direct correlation there.
That's right, and it's nice to see that in Japanese, the entrepreneurial spirit is beginning to come alive. Some of those people who have been laid off from large companies where they thought they had lifetime employment are now taking their future into their own hands.
Last word, Knight. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll have you back again real soon. We enjoyed it.
Hope so, Jim.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Knight Kiplinger, ladies and gentlemen, the editor of the Kiplinger Letters and the author of World Boom Ahead. Check that out at your bookstores. Got to wrap it up for this hour. Before I go, I want to thank my heroes. This is Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.